This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Hey, listeners, whether you love true crime or comedies, celebrity interviews, news, or even motivational speakers, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue, right? And guess what? Now you can call the shots on your auto insurance. Enter the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. The Name Your Price tool puts you in charge of your auto insurance by working just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance. Then they'll show you a variety of coverages that fit within your budget, giving you options. It's easy to start a quote. You'll be able to choose the best option for you. It's fast. Now that's something you'll want to press play on. It's easy to start a quote, and you'll be able to choose the best option for you. It is just one of many ways you can save with Progressive Insurance. Quote today at progressive.com to try the Name Your Price tool for yourself and join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Pricing coverage match limited by state law.
This podcast is sponsored by Ramp. Are you the decision maker in your company? Consider this. For the first time in decades, there's a better option for a corporate card and spend management platform. Meet Ramp, the only corporate card and spend management system designed to help you spend less money so you can make more. Most corporate credit cards offer points as incentives, but those points amount to less than their worth in real cash value. Ramp's business cards offer you cash back, real money in your pocket. Plus, you control who spends what with each vendor. And Ramp software collects and verifies receipts automatically, which means you'll stop wasteful spending and close your books in hours instead of days. Businesses that use Ramp add up to 5% to their bottom line the first year. If you're a decision maker, adding Ramp could be one of the best decisions you've ever made. And now get $250 when you join Ramp for free. Just go to ramp.com/easy. ramp.com/easy. ramp.com/easy.
Cards issued by Sutton Bank and Celtic Bank, members FDIC. Terms and conditions apply.
Most weekdays, journalist Andrew Rice shows up to a criminal court in Manhattan and confronts a surreal scene. The former president of the United States defending himself against 34 felony counts.
I mean, it's quite tense, as you might imagine.
The absurdity still has not worn off yet for anyone.
You can sort of tell when things are heating up because all of a sudden you start hearing the keyboards clattering a little louder and a little faster. The reporters will actually be posting things, and then Donald Trump's Truth Social account will be commenting on things that are happening in the court while Donald Trump is sitting right there. So it's all kind of quite postmodern, and I guess appropriately for Donald Trump, a lot of it's happening online.
Part of what interests Andrew is the people sitting next to Trump, the attorneys who are making his case for him. Trump's got a whole swarm of them at this point. And in his previous trials, the civil trials, these lawyers definitely had a style.
Well, I would characterize them as being MAGA.
As you might expect, that led to some boisterous performances, like at the E. Jean Carroll defamation trial, where the judge was vocally critical of one attorney in particular.
He criticized her for not knowing the kind of technical rules about how you introduce evidence in federal court. At one point, the judge threatened to hold her in contempt. He said she was on the verge of spending a night in the lockup. The ultimate result was an $83 million verdict against him.
Not a great outcome.
Not a great outcome.
This case, Andrew says, it's different. There's a whole new cast of characters. Trump has retained a noted mob defense attorney. And then there's his lead attorney, a guy named Todd Blanche.
And now he basically represents Donald Trump full time.
There are a number of things about Todd Blanche that I think would surprise my listeners, like the fact that until a year ago, he was a registered Democrat, that he used to work in the same office as the prosecutor here, Manhattan DA Alvin Bragg. Like, all that is kind of surprising to me.
You know, I talked with Blanche, and he was pretty open and candid with me in my conversations about sort of why he took the case. But talking with his friends, there's a lot of people who are just absolutely kind of dumbfounded by the decision, and it's caused a lot of consternation within that community. People asking, you know, why is Todd doing this? Why would somebody who was a prosecutor, someone who's committed to the system, an institutionalist, take on a client who's committed to kind of tearing down those very institutions?
Today on the show, the man defending Trump. Why exactly is he there? And is he the secret weapon that could keep Trump out of jail? I'm Mary Harris. You're listening to What Next? Stick around. This episode is brought to you by Burrow. You know, as soon as the weather starts getting a little warmer, I think most of us try to spend a lot more time outside. I'm lucky enough to have a little patch of backyard in the city, so this is the season where I'm planting stuff and throwing a ball around for my dog. But my favorite thing to do is just sit on my deck and have a cup of coffee and ignore the dishes in my sink. So the furniture company Burrow made a deal with me. They'd send over some outdoor furniture, I could try it out, and tell you if it made perching on my glorified fire escape each morning better. This is how I ended up with a whole bunch of boxes rolling through my front door the other day, which I kind of saw with dread. But here's the deal. My teenager and I assembled an entire outdoor couch in an hour or two. And while it did involve an Allen wrench, I can tell you, the final product does not look or feel like a piece of furniture that was assembled using an Allen wrench. First of all, it is solid wood. It's teak. Second of all, it's sturdy as hell. With my old backyard furniture, I always kind of felt like I was going to slip off, but I could spend all day in the sectional. There's even a little table built into this thing, so I've got a place to put my coffee mug in the morning. And when I'm working at home, I can work outside. No matter what you choose, Burrow will always give you free shipping, too. And if all this is making you curious, I've got one more piece of news. What Next listeners can get 15% off their first order at burrow.com/whatnext. That's Burrow, burrow.com/whatnext for 15% off. burrow.com/whatnext. This episode is brought to you by Discover. When it comes to your finances, Discover wants you to know they are the credit card that is always there for you. With 24/7 US-based live customer service, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, that means no more waiting for, quote, normal business hours just to get a hold of someone. We are talking real service from real people whenever you need it. Get the customer service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. When I asked Andrew Rice to explain how this attorney, Todd Blanche, became the person helming what's arguably the most important criminal trial in the country, he wanted me to know about Blanche's grit. Andrew says, Blanche's pedigree just doesn't look like that of a lot of top-tier New York attorneys.
He bounced around in college a bit, ended up at American University, and graduated from there. American, you know, obviously good school, but like, you know, not Ivy League. And after that, he became a paralegal in the Justice Department, ultimately ended up working as a paralegal in the Southern District of New York, which is maybe the most prestigious federal prosecutor's office in the whole country. So he's working there as a paralegal and going to Brooklyn Law School at night.
And he's married with like kids at this point, right?
By the time he was in about 25 years old, he was married and had two kids and was living on Long Island. Very different kind of life and background than a lot of the people he was working with who in that office, you know, you have people who have been Supreme Court clerks. You have people who went to Harvard and Yale Law School. He would kind of joke, make fun of them a little bit and call them Harvards.
Like Harvard undergrad, Harvard Law School.
Yes, exactly. And he became a supervisor there very quickly. So he was the boss for a lot of the Harvards. So, you know, the way that he described it to me is he would sort of say, like, if somebody worked for him, came in, they would make a suggestion. And he's like, well, you know, I'm not a Harvard, but maybe I think that we should do this, is, you know.
Huh. Sounds like he had a good reputation at the U.S. Attorney's Office.
My general sense was that he was somebody who was really beloved there. You know, I think people thought that he had this kind of institutional ethos. You know, he believed in the cause there in the Southern District. And it can kind of sound corny to outsiders, but those folks really do believe that they are, you know, the elite people trying to uphold law and order in New York. So they're prosecuting, at that time, they're prosecuting Al-Qaeda terrorists. They're prosecuting Bernie Madoff at that time.
Eventually, Todd Blanche left his job at the Southern District and went corporate. He was working at a white shoe law firm in Manhattan, Cadwalader. It's a firm that likes to call itself the oldest in New York City. And that's when Blanche started entering Trump's orbit, slowly at first. He started by representing Paul Manafort, Trump's 2016 campaign manager. He actually got a case against Manafort thrown out of court. Then Blanche was retained by Trump world political strategist Boris Epstein. His job was to build up a staff of attorneys for the criminal cases the former president was staring down.
He's acting as a sort of consultant to Boris Epstein, who is kind of running point on all this. And they were not having a ton of success. They were going to all these law firms. They're saying money is no object. We have a super PAC. It's got hundreds of millions of dollars. And they're not getting firms to say yes. We're not jumping at the chance to represent Donald Trump. And eventually Blanche decided that he would do it himself.
So he did a Dick Cheney. He's like, I'm going to be in charge of the vice presidential search committee, and it's me.
Well, he jokingly made that same comparison to me. And I think that he told me that he came to feel as if there was hypocrisy in the legal community that he came from about representing Donald Trump. He said, you know, Jeffrey Epstein can get representation. You know, mobsters can get representation. But the former president of the United States, for some reason, he is beyond the pale. And that didn't sit well with Blanche. And so he decided he wanted to take the case. His partners at Cadwalader said, no, you can't take it. If you want to take it, you're going to have to quit. And so he said, you know, I quit.
It's a real statement about your own confidence with this case.
I mean, it is both a fantastically risky bet on Blanche's part, on himself, and on another level, I mean, many attorneys that I talked to saw it another way, which was that, you know, this is the biggest case that there is. And if you represent Donald Trump in this case, represent him successfully, you suddenly become the person who took on the most, you know, the hardest case in the hardest jurisdiction.
Now that he's in the courtroom, unable to avoid a trial, as far as you can tell, what is Todd Blanche's plan?
So his plan, and they're pretty open about this, is to go for mistrial. I don't think anyone on the defense team or anywhere else, maybe not even Donald Trump himself, thinks that they're going to win a full acquittal in New York.
A mistrial basically means, like, depending on one juror to just hold out and say no.
One or more. Yeah. I mean, I think that basically their impetus here is to try to peel away one or two jurors, or three or four, but like a segment of jurors, and get them thinking that this is like, that Donald Trump is not a laudable person, that this person is not a good person, but that the case that's been brought against him is political, and that the case that's been brought against him is kind of penny ante. And so during jury selection, there was a lot of attempt to kind of find jurors who might be willing to listen to Donald Trump, if not necessarily to like him. I mean, jury selection was sort of fascinating because the number of people who said that they're just be unable to set their bias aside and judge Donald Trump on the merits of the case was really staggering.
And that was like a get out of jury free card, essentially.
It was. I mean, and you know, you understand why the judge did it, because he brought in you know, basically two groups of 96 people. First question they asked just everybody is like, raise your hand if you don't feel like you can judge Donald Trump. And in both cases, about half of them raised their hand and walked out.
So the jury's been seated. and they'll make the final decision here. But during the trial, it's the judge who runs a courtroom. In this case, the judge is named Juan Merchan. How is he interacting with Todd Blanche and his team?
Well, not very well. You know, I think that, and this is not bled into the trial itself in the presence of the jury yet. So one question is how much the jury is really going to see this. But outside of the presence of the jury, there's been a lot of tension, a lot of back and forth between Blanche and the judge. Really, the big thing where they're clashing is over this gag order that that Merchan put on Donald Trump for the case. Trump is prohibited from attacking or otherwise trying to intimidate witnesses, prosecutors, members of the prosecutors' families, and maybe most importantly, jurors.
The prosecutors want him held in contempt, right? Because they're saying he's not abiding by the gag order.
That's right. And the prosecutors came in and argued. It presented, I think, you know, 11 social media posts, including, and then even they cited some of Trump's comments, you know, outside the courtroom the day before. You know, in each case, you know, either calling, you know, his accusers or witnesses for the prosecution sleaze bags. In one case, it was really quite damaging to Trump, I think. He reposted a Fox News segment that suggested that some of the jurors were liberal activists. After that happened, the juror in question actually came in and quit. This was during the jury selection process. The judge was not happy about that at all. And so I think there's a very high probability that Donald Trump will be held in contempt.
What kind of arguments did Blanche have to make in order to explain these kind of posts?
Well, I mean, he basically had to sort of try to justify the unjustifiable. Blanche said to Merchan at one point that, you know, Donald Trump is trying to comply with this gag order, which is to say, I think what he was trying to say was that Trump was trying to limit his criticisms only to people that were not covered by the gag order or to responding to political attacks. And the judge just wasn't having any of that argument. He called it silly. And he told Blanche, you know, you're losing all credibility with this court.
That's not where any attorney wants to be when you're arguing in front of that judge.
Yeah. I mean, I think in some ways, Merchan was just saying the quiet part out loud because, you know, I don't think that Merchan was treating him or Trump's defense team before that as if he felt as if they had much credibility. So
what does this exchange tell you about how you think the rest of this case will go?
Well, I think what's going to happen, I suspect, is that you're going to have a kind of contempt feedback loop. And I think juries frown on that and frown on people trying to attack the system and attack the integrity of the process in which they're participating. So I think it could end up having extremely negative consequences for Trump. Both in terms of the verdict and in terms of sentencing. Merchan is known for being a very harsh sentencer, especially with white-collar defendants. Merchan has, in other contexts, with Alan Weisselberg, most notably, who was a chief financial officer of the Trump Organization, pleaded guilty to some financial crimes, has put people in jail, has put people on Rikers Island. I've talked to people who were involved in previous cases in front of him who think that it's entirely possible that this judge could sentence Donald Trump to jail.
After the break, why even the best attorney might not be competent enough for Donald Trump.
Hi, this is Dahlia Lithwick, host of Slate's legal podcast, Amicus. If you're listening to this show, you might be interested in Amicus's live show that we're hosting in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday, May the 14th. My colleague, Mark Joseph Stern, and I will be talking to some amazing guests, including Sherrilyn Ifill and a sitting state Supreme Court justice, all about how originalism, a relatively recently invented way of interpreting the Constitution, has taken over the Supreme Court and radically reshaped the law. It's been doctrinal rocket fuel for the conservative legal movement and facilitated the rolling back of abortion rights, the expansion of gun rights, and the obliteration of the separation of church and state. And as another wildly consequential Supreme Court term careers to its end, the court's originalists are on a tear. But there's something you can do about it, and we hope you'll join us in D.C. on May 14th to explore the possible pathways out of the current situation. Go to slate.com/amicuslive for tickets.
Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title the Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of 4 episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
You know, looking at your article, which gets into Trump's criminal trial strategy and the guy leading it, Todd Blanche, something stood out to me about Blanche, which is that he seems like a classic attorney, like the kind of attorney who's able to look at the legal system as a strategy game. And he's a competitor. He's an Ironman competitor, literally. He wants to win, but he can also like shake off losses and pivot and try to find a new winning strategy. This approach, this cool approach, it seems harder to manage if you think your client is a threat to American democracy. So I'm kind of curious, do you think Blanche sees his client that way?
No, he doesn't.
Huh.
In some ways, I think the attacks that Blanche has felt from his own profession have sort of hardened his determination to represent Donald Trump. And, you know, he is now living part-time in Florida near Palm Beach. He's a registered Republican. He believes, I think pretty earnestly, that Donald Trump's political opponents are using the legal system to try to destroy Donald Trump as a political figure. And I think he thinks that that is an inappropriate use of prosecutorial power. And so, you know, you can have a different view of that question, and I certainly do. But I think it seems quite clear that Blanche is earnest in thinking that it's not a good look for democracy to be prosecuting a presidential candidate in the midst of a campaign in which he's perhaps the leading candidate in the polls over, you know, in Manhattan, what is a relatively minor financial infraction. You know, there's a long tradition in, you know, in the law that, you know, everyone's entitled to vigorous legal defense. And there's a lot of people who think, you know, Donald Trump, of all people, should have a competent lawyer because, you know, if you think it's a bad look for democracy to be prosecuting a presidential candidate in the midst of an election, it would be even worse to have that person to be incompetently represented and not given the full opportunity to defend himself in court. You know, of course, the problem is that even the most competent lawyer can't overcome a self-sabotaging client.
Yeah. I mean, that really is the problem with representing Trump, the fact that you're always representing Trump, like no matter where you go, there you are, by which I mean, like as a client, he's just hard to control. You can't say, be quiet. You can't say, don't do that, because there's just really solid evidence he won't listen to you. Like I look at one of the cases that Blanche himself is handling, the classified documents case in Florida. And as part of that case, stories have come out about Trump's attorneys at the time telling him, if you don't respond to these subpoenas about classified documents, that's a crime. It didn't make a difference, I don't think. But I guess I wonder, when you're someone like Todd Blanche, you have all of this information and evidence that the people who came before you were incredibly exposed. So does Todd Blanche have red lines here? Things he'll do, things he'll not do? How does he think about that?
Well, I think that probably goes beyond the scope of like what I know, and maybe what anybody knows, even Todd Blanche knows about you know, where Todd Blanche is on this. I mean, I think I can say, generally speaking, I think a lot of the individuals who represent Donald Trump, and I've talked to many of them, you know, many of them go in thinking, well, I'm gonna control him. I'm gonna be the one who's gonna be the Trump whisperer and bring him around to, you know, realizing that it's in his, not just in the interest of the system, but in his own best interest to behave and to moderate his behavior, to act differently, to respect the process, et cetera, et cetera. And the people who try to manage him and the people who try to control him end up either quitting in frustration or compromising themselves. And I think that's where Todd Blanche is right now. It's in the process of figuring out how much he's going to allow Trump to manage him and how much, you know, where that line is, and how far he will go in terms of, you know, allowing Trump to disrupt the process.
Yeah. In the next few weeks, as the trial continues, I mean, you've said Todd Blanche and the attorneys for Trump are not having a great time of it in front of the judge. What are you watching for to see if they're able to turn things around? Or is turning things around kind of not the point? Like, the point is just to focus like a laser on getting that one or two or three jurors who will just flip it for you.
I think there's two things. One is the kind of mistrial strategy, trying to hang the jury, what's called the jury nullification strategy. But I think that actually Trump has a bigger strategy that is not about the court, which is just a grander nullification strategy, which is that, you know, if he wins the election, a lot of these problems go away. So I think that the thing to really watch over the course of the next few weeks is how much is what's happening in the court impacting the political dynamic? Because ultimately, this isn't going to end with a verdict of 12 people in New York. It's going to end with a verdict of a couple hundred million people at the polls in November. You know, that's going to be the verdict that's going to matter. And if Donald Trump loses that, he's in all likelihood going to end up being convicted, not just in Manhattan, but he's in all likelihood going to – he will – very likely be convicted in Washington, D.C. in the January 6th case. He will very likely be, almost certainly be convicted in Florida in the classified documents case. You know, who knows what's going to happen in Georgia, but nonetheless, he'll face very strong legal consequences, I think.
It's almost like these cases don't matter as much as, I mean, what you're saying is the cases themselves right now are not the focus.
Well, I think that if he wins the election, that it solves all of his problems, legally speaking. So I think it's not that they don't matter. I mean, I think that they all have a political impact and they all add to the stakes of this election. But ultimately, it'll be in the hands of voters and in the hands of the Electoral College whether this, in fact, ends with a conviction or whether it ends with Donald Trump being restored to power.
Andrew Rice, thank you so much for coming on the show. I'm grateful.
Of course. Thanks.
Andrew Rice is a features writer for New York Magazine. He's also the author of The Year That Broke America. And that's our show. If you're a fan of what we're doing here at What Next, the best way to support our work is to join Slate Plus. Go on over to slate.com/whatnextplus to find out how. What Next is produced by Paige Osborne, Elena Schwartz, Rob Gunther, Anna Phillips, and Madeline Ducharme. We're led by Alicia Montgomery with a little boost from Susan Matthews. Ben Richmond is the Senior Director of Podcast Operations here at Slate. And I'm Mary Harris. You can go track me down on X if you want. I'm at Mary's desk. Thanks for listening. I'll catch you back here next time.
I'm Dahlia Lithwick, and I'm host of Amicus, Slate's podcast about the law and the U.S. Supreme Court. We are shifting into high gear, coming at you weekly with the context you need to understand the rapidly changing legal landscape. The many trials of Donald J. Trump, judicial ethics, arguments and opinions at SCOTUS. We are tackling the big legal news with clarity and insight every single week. New Amicus episodes every Saturday, wherever you listen.